Good morning, brothers and sisters. I bring loving greetings from the Lampasas Ecclesia. We'll begin our study class in the Epistle of Paul to the Romans this morning with the study of chapter 1. Though this epistle was not the first of Paul's epistle, being written about around 56 AD, it is well placed first among them in the scriptures, as some have described it as the profoundest book in the world. It is different from most of the other letters Paul wrote in that it does not appear to be written to address specific needs or difficulties facing the ecclesia to which it is addressed. In his epistle to the Romans, Paul lays out his teachings concerning the principles of God's dealings with men. Paul opens the letter by declaring himself to be a servant of Jesus Christ, an apostle, separated unto the gospel of God. Even though he was a freeborn Roman, he gloried in his servitude of Christ. He recognized this relationship with Christ as a great honor, a greater honor than the position of freeman. In this, Paul encouraged the slave to remember that in Christ he is free, while at the same time exhorting the free to remember that he is Christ's slave. There are two aspects of Christ that cannot be separated and must not be ignored. Christ is the Son of God and, at the same time, the Son of Man. It is common practice throughout all of Christendom to raise Christ to be co-equal, co-eternal with God. This denies that he is the Son of God. Others ignore the scriptural record of Christ's birth and make him simply the Son of Man. To do this ignores the entire life, his entire life and works. He was the Son of God as well as the Son of Man. Paul plainly declares these two aspects of Christ, his Davidic descent and his divine sonship. Paul says God's Son, Jesus Christ, was made the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. Through Christ, the Son of David and Son of God, Paul received grace and apostleship. Once he persecuted the Christians, now he edified them to obedience through faith. The brethren at Rome were among those who had obeyed and were saints called of God, called to come out and be separate. In giving thanks for the brethren at Rome, Paul's first thought is toward God. First, I thank my God through Jesus for you all, he writes. This was a commonly displayed characteristic of Paul's, for in many of his epistles he expresses his thanks to God. Paul was constantly in turmoil. Around the time of this letter, that this letter was written, his life was put in peril in the riot of Ephesus found in Acts 19. After leaving Corinth, a plot against his life caused him to change his route. Through all the many trials and hazards which he constantly endured, there was one thing that pressed upon him daily, anxiety for all the ecclesias. It is through this profound, carrying anxiety that Paul writes to the ecclesia at Rome, as he did to the other ecclesias. I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Without ceasing, I make mention of you always in my prayers. He fully realized his great duty. He earnestly served God and unceasingly prayed for those in his charge. Paul's concern was for every member, for we read in 2 Corinthians 11 and 29, who is weak and I am not weak, who is offended and I burn not. Paul's life was spent building an intense empathy, love, and fellowship with his brethren. Paul may have never visited the ecclesia at Rome, but it is clear from this epistle that he knew many of them, and he had many times planned to visit Rome, but had so far not been able to do so. He longed to see them, that he might impart some spiritual benefit to them. This must be the reason that we visit and associate with one another, and this aspect of our fellowship must be constantly kept in mind. Any time of our association with one another not spent to this end is time wasted, unfaithful stewardship, and a lost opportunity. Paul's life was guided by the Spirit, directly and indirectly. Certainly, God revealed to him where he should go, but he also used the circumstances around him to guide him, such as Demetrius the silversmith in Ephesus. In his long periods of confinement, while a physical hardship allowed for much study and meditation, it also allowed Paul, guided by the Spirit of God, to write the epistles that we study today. A busy, active, worldly life would not have afforded itself the time necessary to do this work. Undoubtedly, Paul never wasted his time, and he didn't use his hardships as an excuse to neglect his service to the Lord. The apostle introduces the theme of the epistle in verses 16 and 17. We read, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. To the Jews, Christ crucified was a stumbling block. Jesus' death was to them evidence that he was not the Messiah. How could the Messiah meet with a felon's death? To the Greeks, the gospel was foolishness. They worshipped their own accomplishments, taking pride in their own wisdom. To this end, it was inconceivable to them that a humble carpenter could satisfy their needs. Many aspects of the gospel do not lend themselves to the wise and great of the world. It is a simple, unlearned, unworldly thing, and it requires simple, unworldly people to believe it and value it. There were in Paul's day, and there have been ever since, those who are enamored with worldly learning and are not satisfied with the simple teaching of the gospel. In effect, they are ashamed of it. They feel embarrassed at its simplicity when compared to all the worldly philosophy and theory that abound. The necessary attitude on the part of man is belief in the gospel. Salvation is to everyone that believes. It is made possible for all races. The door was first opened to the Jews, but the same condition applies to all. He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. Paul cuts away from the Jews the hope of salvation by the law. Salvation is not on the condition of works, but of faith. This is the foundation of Paul's opposition to the Judaizers of his day. So why does Paul say that the gospel is the power of God unto salvation? He answers this question in verse 17, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Paul highlights a key Old Testament passage found in Habakkuk 2 and 4, the just shall live by faith. In the early chapters of Romans, Paul is establishing the truth of salvation by faith, as contrasted with salvation by works. Faith, like knowledge, is not an end in itself, but it is a means to an end. We are all familiar with the passage in James 2 and 20, faith without works is dead. Faith, if it does not lead to works, is dead. There must be something accomplished by the power of faith. Our lives must be transformed, and we must be certain that we each give far more attention to this, more than most people appear to be willing to give. And this is made clear by verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men. Not ignore this word all. Take special meaning of this word. This is essential to Paul's line of reasoning. When we read the description of the natural human corruption in the verses that follow, we are liable to be put off track by their very vileness and depravity. In this description of the evilness of mankind, we read of the very worst forms of unrighteousness, but he is speaking of all forms of unrighteousness, no matter how small we might think they are. It is an egregious error with fatal consequences to belittle any sin, however small we might think it to be. If someone can choose to sin, to deliberately disobey the commandments and will of God, and do something contrary to his law of holiness, then the magnitude of sin does not matter, because it is always deadly. Any heart that can choose the will of the flesh over the will of God is dead in sin. Throughout the first few chapters, Paul shows man to be utterly corrupt and lost. The whole world has failed to attain righteousness. The remainder of chapter 1 deals with the failure of the Gentiles, and then the Jewish world is considered. The picture that the apostle draws of the pagan world of this time is a very dark one, but is not limited to one age. It is a wonderful description of the pagan Christianity of today. When Christendom went astray, it quickly returned to paganism in its doctrines. This has left modern Christianity as a mere facade, while remaining fundamentally pagan. Truly, the washed sow has returned to wallow in the mire. The apostle tells us where this path leads, to the outpouring of the wrath of God. In the days of Noah, man's utter wickedness and immorality led to a violent cleansing of the whole earth. Later, mankind's apostasy was punished by the confusion of tongues, and time prevents us from going into detail of the occasions in which the nation of Israel was conquered and carried away. These are obvious manifestations of the wrath of God against ungodliness and unrighteousness, but man has been and continues to be punished in ways less obvious. There are many social evils following mankind as he pursues the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eye, and the pride of life. Men may find many explanations for secondary causes, but the root cause is in the divine arrangements. This is particularly important in light of today's educated, well-learned foolishness that abounds. God has not left himself without witness. In his works of creation, he has given unmistakable and overwhelming evidence of his existence and power. As man observes the works of creation, he has absolutely no excuse for not clearly recognizing the existence of God. However, nature cannot tell us anything of God's purpose with man and what he requires of us. For this, revelation is necessary. And this need has been met in the scriptures. When a man recognizes the hand of God in creation, he then has no excuse for not seeking out knowledge of God and submitting to his will. The description of mankind found in verses 20 to 22 applies as much today as it did of the Roman world of Paul's time. We read, "The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools." What a perfect description of modern man. If this held for the Roman world of Paul's time, with their limited knowledge of the details of the construction of living things, how much more must be the guilt of man today? So instead of seeking out God and submitting to his will, natural man turns his back on God, putting in God's place their own speculations and reasoning. They worship either their equal in other men or their inferior in their own creations, either of which is easy to show could not possibly be the creator. Paul tells us that turning from the worship of God brought about punishment from God. God gave them over to a reprobate mind, a mind void of judgment, to do those things which are not convenient. They had voluntarily chosen a course that led to God abandoning them. This abandonment led to an ever-increasing state of corruption. Therein is a great and sobering lesson to each of us. We see the world all around us giving in ever more to the things of the flesh and worshiping and serving the creature more than the Creator. There is an underlying principle behind this trend, and it is explained right here in Romans chapter 1. God gave them up. God gave them up to uncleanness. God gave them up to vile affections. God gave them up to a mind void of judgment. When someone chooses the first step in an ungodly direction, God eventually gives up on them to go all the way. The vile things spoken of by Paul are all around us, continually lapping at the doors. We must keep a constant vigil against these things, not only in our own lives, but also within our fellowship. Where much is given, much is required, and we each have been given a very precious thing in the truth. We know that the world has been led down the path to its current godless state by the three unclean spirits like frogs. Things that were abhorred a few short years ago are now almost universally accepted. If we allow ourselves to sway with the fashions, morals, and emotions of the world, we too will find ourselves in the same state. One small step in the wrong direction may be the first of many down a sinful, wicked path, at the end of which awaits rejection and death. Brethren and sisters, let us run with patience the race that is set before us, at the end of which will be heard those long-awaited words, "Well done, good and faithful servant, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord."